So the next of the Parmes that I'd like to speak about a little is the one of truthfulness. Now, clearly this has much to do with wise action, with wise speech. It has much to do with ethics. It is probably actually one of the most challenging paramis in our lives to embody. Because truthfulness is really speaking about the manner of our engagements, the manner of our relationships with the world and with ourselves. How we engage, relate through our speech, our actions, and the kind of thoughts that we entertain. Essentially about the kind of thoughts that we entertain. The thoughts that we entertain about ourselves and about others. I think truthfulness speaks a lot to the kind of image making we engage in, the image building we engage in about ourselves or about others. And though sometimes being mindful, you know, we all know that being mindful of our minds is the most challenging aspect of mindfulness practice. And yet truthfulness is really asking us to be mindful of our minds, the shape of our minds, the activities of our minds, particularly in the realm of judgment, fixing ourselves and others in place through judgment or through image, to really be able to ask of our thoughts, are they kind? Are they rooted in aversion? Are they rooted in speculation? Are they rooted in fear? Because these are all the spectrum of emotions that tends to most move us away from truthfulness. One of the, you know, the kind of metaphors I use, you know, I mean, many of you have been on retreats and know how deeply important, for example, that mealtimes become. And, you know, I saw this happen on retreat. Fortunately, it wasn't with my mind, I'm very happy to say. But somebody said, you know, they saw, you know, it was a day when there were potatoes, and they saw the person in front of them take the last potato. And forever after, through this silent retreat, every time they saw that person, it was the person who took the last potato. I mean, aware of how we do this in our lives, you know, based on some insult or some affront or something that we have speculated about in others or judged in others, how our perceptions, you know, the moment we re-see that person, that perception of the past comes to the forefront, and that's the lens through which we see. There's a whole lot of work being done right now, which I'm refusing the temptation to get into, but how mindfulness affects working memory, and about how working memory is how we function in this world, that we have the conceptual working memory through which we label and then we identify things in the world, and then we have the emotional working memory. And our emotional working memory is shockingly lacking and contracted. The associations we have with our concepts and our images is so limited, it's extraordinary. And what this practice is actually doing and shown to be doing in research trials is of course expanding the breadth of our emotional working memory, so that perception is not constantly being refiltered and recycled through the same associations that allows us to see something anew. And this is essentially a much to do with truthfulness. That because we can see, whenever we see ourselves or another through the lens of how they have been frozen in place through perception association. We do not allow them to change. We do not allow ourselves to change. We do not allow anything to be seen anew. We actually close the door on understanding. And very often we close the door on compassion. And in the Sufi tradition, there's a kind of saying that in being mindful of your thoughts, let them pass through three gates. And in the first gate, you ask of your thoughts, are these helpful? And if so, let them continue. Second gate, are they kind? If so, let them continue. And the third gate, are they true? Are they true? As we know, our minds being the forerunners of all things, truthfulness in our minds, truthfulness in our thoughts has much to do then with truthfulness in our speech. And, you know, truthfulness in speech doesn't mean, you know, it's not about these extremes of I'm either truthful or I'm lying. There's a whole middle ground there, isn't there? A whole middle ground which has to do actually often with self-making. Often with self-making. If you notice, say for exaggeration, if you notice how that difficult sitting becomes more and more difficult each time you tell the story of it, you know, until you were essentially lying on beds of nails, tormented by demons, it was just a difficult sitting. Mm-hmm. I have a student who committed to practicing wise speech, truthful, kind, appropriate, for a year. And she said it changed her life. And it changed all of her relationships. That no one actually cornered her anymore to be a partner in gossip because they knew it wasn't happening. People knew they weren't gossip. She wasn't gossiping about them. She became a place of safety, a place of refuge for people. A person who could be trusted. But the domain of wise speech is not only, of course, not about just not exaggerating or lying. The domain of wise speech is also about how to say the difficult and the truthful without fear, and yet with consideration of the right time and tone. The thing about truthfulness, the way it's so related to ethics and integrity, is that truthfulness, of course, has much to do with calming the heart and mind, simply because we don't have any fear of being found out, of being discovered or caught in some kind of exaggeration, and there's no residues in the mind. And if we look at sometimes what makes us exaggerate or to avoid truthfulness, sometimes it is about making me more special. You know, making me bigger somehow, more admirable, more worthy of approval. And it's so important to actually have the humility to look at those moments in our mind when we might be slightly less than totally honest and be able to ask, well, what's really going on here? What's actually going on? Truthfulness in our actions, truthfulness in our choices, is all about what is being embodied in our lives. It is so easy, as we've mentioned, to have that gap between what we value or feel we value and how we embody it. How do we embody kindness that we value? How do we embody the compassion we value? How do we embody the fearlessness we value? What is being embodied that which leads to calmness, to insight and compassion, or leads away? I think truthfulness is essentially about aligning our speech and our actions and our thoughts with what we most deeply value, what we feel to be of most enduring and liberating value in our lives. And this is a lot about what our practice is all about, isn't it? It's about practicing alignment. Practicing that connection and that alignment. And that, I think, for most of us really is a path. Do you have any questions about truthfulness? Because I'm not going to linger in this area too much longer. Yeah.
What about truthfulness in the face of conflict? That maybe sometimes we don't really know. We don't know because it's about two people. It's about
two other people.
It's about another person's experience as well as your own experience, and you. You may be tapping into things that you're not even aware of that may not seem initially kind or hopeful, but that actually is illuminating something that is painful but necessary.
And the truth is sometimes we don't know. I mean, I think it's very important to acknowledge that. You know, because I think one of the great sort of opponents of truthfulness is too much certainty. You're like that. I'm like this. It's too much certainty, I think, is one of the opponents of truthfulness. And I think in a relationship, truthfulness is perhaps something people come to together. You know, do you ever find yourself sort of being just slightly suspicious of the conclusions we might come to about what's actually going on? And sometimes only to discover we actually don't know the whole story countless times. Countless times. And that has much to do with dissolving images, doesn't it? You know, I think of a simple example. I remember someone telling me, you know, how their roommate on a retreat was so insensitive because they were so noisy and they were so, and their alarm clock was going off. And then at the end of the retreat, they discovered they were deaf. But they went through the entire retreat, you know, certain of the truth of their perception. Many of our perceptions, of course, are tapping into all kinds of associations and speculations that we don't know are true. And I think there's a lot of wisdom. We don't like not knowing. That's not comfortable territory for most people. But I think there's a lot of wisdom in being able to hang out in that territory with the intention to understand. You know, so we're not abandoning it, but with the intention to understand. So I want to go into this next parami, which is determination, which looks a lot like virya. It looks a lot like that kind of energy, but it is slightly different flavor. As I mentioned, the word for heroism is virya. The word for determination is aditana. Aditana, it's a different word. It has a lot of crossover, I think, with heroism. But it's more the determination to be free from suffering and struggle. And I think it's a determination to ask the very same questions that were asked around the time of the Buddha. What do I need to develop in order to know the mind of a Buddha? That kind of determination. The determination to walk the path no matter what the circumstances, being undissuaded. I think it is determination to be let renounce distractedness, essentially. Especially the distractedness that is pursued in order to camouflage discomfort. We are lived with so many choices moment to moment, aren't we, around discomfort. I mean, and most of our choices to avoid are easier than our choice to stay with. Yeah? It is so much easier to turn on the TV than to look at our minds. You know, it is so much easier to you know, go online and spend an hour, you know, looking at websites rather than to stay with discomfort in our body. I think determination for me relies upon a certain disillusionment with samsara. It's a positive disillusionment. It's not saying samsara is bad. You know, I've said a million times, there's much that is of it, but a certain disillusionment with samsara. How many pieces of chocolate do we need to eat before we realize it does not provide lasting happiness? How many things are the gatekeepers of our happiness before we realize it need not be so? How many times can we become urgent in our cravings before we realize they are not delivering? They're actually not delivering. The Buddha began his path with disappointment. And it was a positive disappointment. The Buddha, as a young man, when he began on this path, was a deeply disappointed young man. He was not a person who lived in dire poverty and deprivation. He was a person, you know, by the standards of his time, although it's not true he was a prince, but by the standards of his time, you know, had much in terms of identity and security and possessions. But he was disappointed. It didn't deliver. Didn't deliver what he felt to be important. And I think this kind of disillusionment with samsara is actually really the beginning in many ways of our own path. And, you know, I have this thing about not negotiating with samsara or not trying to negotiate with the three characteristics. You know, that we can spend so much time negotiating, well, you know, I'll practice a little here as long as things are good, you know, or maybe I'll just do a little bit of craving, you know, but not too much, you know, so I don't get a bad reputation, you know, and you know, it doesn't really matter if I just, you know, spend a lot of my time kind of manipulating conditions. It doesn't really work. It's not a rejection of the world. But somehow that real sense that, you know, what is we do not discover within, we will not discover without. You know, we will not discover externally. It's most easy to be dissuaded by our own minds. You know, we can be in love with our fantasies. We can be in love with our obsessions. We can be dissuaded by doubt. Perhaps this is the most paralyzing of all. You know, that we get dissuaded by doubt. Not really having the confidence that we have the possibility to know the same insights as the Buddha saw. To know the mind of a Buddha. So determination has a big place. You know, it's not about forcing. It's something quieter, I think, determination. I think determination is quite a quiet commitment. It is the confidence of really knowing the wisdom of the path and the determination to walk it, and the confidence in our own capacity for liberation. It's not easily come to, but it is about confidence. We need to, you know, as we've talked about, no one's path has a linear development. Everybody's going to have moments when they feel they don't get anywhere, when there's very little rewards. But it's so important that our practice is not governed by experience, that we hold the long view. And the long view is what this path is in the service of, that it really is, only ever has been, in the service of liberation, the liberation from greed, hatred, delusion, the liberation of an awakened heart. Now, determination allows us to walk through that landscape of events and experiences without feeling disheartened or discouraged. You know, I often think of this in walking meditation. You know, that walking meditation, when you go up and down your walking path, there's something there about where you're learning to walk through mental states. You know, you just walk through them. doing your walking meditation, sometimes you're present, sometimes you feel not present, sometimes you're doubtful, sometimes you're bored, you know, sometimes you're interested, and you just stay on the path and you walk through the mental states. And there's something, I think, in our minds about so not being governed by passing events and experiences, not investing so much importance in passing events and experiences. And I often think in that walking path metaphor, there is a beginning of a walking meditation, there is a sustaining, and there is a completion. And it's kind of a metaphor for our lives, isn't it? I mean, some people really have a hard time beginning. Some people are great at beginning. A lot of people have a hard time sustaining. I mean, you see that in walking meditation. Now you walk, you're beginning, filled, yes, you know, 10 minutes later, another good idea arises. You know? And yet, everything tells us in our lives, in every area of our lives, what we do, if we don't sustain, we don't complete. That nothing can be completed without that middle piece of sustaining. And I think that is one of the most powerful lessons of walking practice, is learning to sustain. And that's where determination comes in. And determination has something also to do with sustaining the steadiness of intention. I think of this, when I teach at IMS a lot, you know, and in the past it used to be the sort of hangout place for all the local dogs, because you would have all these affection-deprived yogis, and all the local dogs knew that if they came to IMS, they were going to get showered, you know, with affection and strokes and, you know, cuddles and all the rest of it. And then, but we weren't allowed to feed them. So these dogs, you know, would start going down the driveway to get home. Oh, and another yogi would stroke them. They'd be following them back up the driveway. You know, they'd remember again they were hungry. No, somebody else would stroke them. The tail would be wagging. They're back up at the center. It would take them hours to get to their meal. Now think about, you know, they just forgot the intention. They just forgot what they were doing. There is something about, in this path of determination, we always need to be mindful of not holding too much inflated expectation about our practice and ourselves, but we also need to be so careful of not holding too few expectations. And I personally meet far more of the latter than the former in teaching in the West. I don't see so many people who've got problems with overinflated expectations that I'm going to be liberated on this retreat. But I certainly see the danger of too few expectations. And this is, I think, has much to do with determination. It's closely aligned with a sense of possibility. You know, if there's no sense of possibility, we will settle for too little in this path. We'll settle for too little. So look at the ways that determination comes and how it wavers. You know, we can, you know, so have so much determination after a crisis in our life, but the moment we're a little more calm, we think that's enough. You know, I'm a little more calm, I'm not in such crisis. We can have lukewarm determination. You know, what I consider more tepid determination, when I practice when I feel like it, you know, or if I have enough time. And we can have overfired determination, where we become very rigid about goals and expectations. Determination has much to do with knowing what is of enduring significance, but it's also what rescues our practice from fanciful thinking. You know, I'd really like to be compassionate, or I'd really like to be kind, but, and then the conditions come in, or the problems. So determination, in my understanding, is the link that translates ideals and intentions into embodiment. It's the necessary link. Determination has much to do, as I think I've already mentioned, with confidence, or sometimes translated as faith, not a very good translation. Have we looked so carefully at our minds, at our hearts? Have we looked so carefully at the landscape of this world of so many cycles of difficulty and anguish, and looked to see both their causes and the possibility of their end? The resoluteness or the determination comes in the path, born of that investigation, born of that insight. Determination also comes from inspiration. Have you ever noticed when you've had just a glimpse of stillness, you know, or a glimpse of joy, or a glimpse of happiness in the practice, the inspiration that comes from that? But the inspiration also needs to be insight rooted, that glimpse is a little bit of a window into what is deeply possible for us in terms of really profound stillness and profound joy. Determination means we become collected, we become focused, we become intentional. Does anybody have anything about determination? I'm not in such a rush, by the way, that there's no room for any reflections. Do we have anything about determination? Yeah.
What is the shadow side that you say of determination?
A sort of rigidity, striving, forcing, inflated goals. And I think it's also, I think part of that shadow side is it decreases sensitivity, that we don't always listen inwardly. You know, I saw this many times practicing in Asia, where people would have such determination, for example, being carried out of meditation rooms, locked in full lotus positions, you know, after sitting with 3 hours without moving. And there was, you know, mighty determination there, but not a whole lot of sensitivity to the body. You know, so that's the kind of downside of stop listening. You know, stop, it can prevent kindness or compassion based on listening. But we have a very, you know, I think this whole area of, you know, need in Western culture has become a bit of a kind of maze, you know, because we have developed this kind of very legitimized sense of what I need has become quite big. You know, and sometimes I question that. You know, I need this. You know, I need a certain amount of space, or I need a certain, you know, I need this food, or I need this, you know, this time, or I need this in order to be able to practice. To me, I find it quite challenging, that one. You know, because it's hard to say to somebody, do you really need this? Because it so undermines determination when there are so many conditions about being present and about in being wholehearted. And yet some of those needs are also not irrelevant.
I think that goes a little further. Instead of need, sometimes it's I deserve.
I think you're right. That it can go further, that need has become almost hardened into a sense of I deserve. And sometimes it's not until they're really, not until they're really challenged, whether we really see whether that's true. I remember not long ago someone coming on a retreat at Gaia House who, you know, burst into tears because they didn't get the single room they were expecting and thought that they absolutely needed. And they did end up saying it was the first time in their life they'd ever had the courage to practice with discomfort. Mm-hmm. And that it was a true revelation. And it was a whole movement from that sense of I must have to that sense of questioning.
I'm a little confused when you say that you shouldn't let go of the goal of enlightenment or awakening. Because I also hear a lot that if you just stay on the path, and I mean, it was the thing, the very thing you opened this weekend with was the idea that there's the path and then there's the ripening. And the ripening, and then there's sort of a naturalization. And it felt when you were saying that, that this would, the awakening would happen if you just stayed focused on the cultivating the heart. So now I'm kind of hearing you say, don't forget to keep your eye on the outside.
Saying both. I think the difficulty with practice in our culture is that the outcome gets almost not mentioned. It's almost become a taboo to speak about liberation as a goal of the path. And I'm not saying that we should somehow all become, you know, I'm going to be liberated tomorrow, but I think it's so important to remember this path does have a completion. It does have an ending.
Well, I think it's hard to imagine one would ever become liberated when the Buddha took all those zillions of lifetimes to have it happen. That we would ever have it happen in this little tiny piece of
the armor. Buddha was very clear that liberation's possible in this lifetime.
It's very clear on that.
Mm-hmm. When we hear the stories of all the zillions of lifetimes, they're more about perfecting the paramis.
So
you have to hear these as teaching stories, please.
Okay.
Please hear them as teaching stories, not necessarily as literal truths. All that we actually know is that we have this lifetime. That's all that we know. Everything else is in the realm of speculation. It's all that we know. Certainly in Buddhist teachings, it's very clear that liberation, in fact, the suttas, the discourses, are absolutely saturated with stories of people's awakening. Ordinary folks. You know, not particularly specially merited or endowed or anything else. Ordinary folks. That was the whole excitement's not the right word. But there was the whole energy of the Buddha's teaching life, was that sense of possibility that people came out of nowhere and understood. But what's important to understand, not some particular experience, people saw the same insights the Buddha saw. They came to the same insights that the Buddha saw. Not talking about some necessarily particular state or experience, people saw the same insights that the Buddha saw as profoundly as he saw them.
Is it possible to have had an awakening and then lose it?
We have millions of awakenings.
It happens.
We're talking about unshakable awakening. We have millions of awakenings. You know, there's many times when there's moments of insight where something is so unarguably true and seen. You know, but we're talking about that continuing kind of ripening into unshakable insight. So there's no argument. There's no falling back. It's curious, and you know, I mean, this is a much longer discussion, but the Buddha actually doesn't talk about a state or a particular experience. He talks about an understanding. He talks about the understanding being liberating and uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion. And I think people sometimes get very sort of disheartened or confused because they're waiting for a Bodhi tree experience. You know? But when the Buddha got up from the Bodhi tree, he talked about what he understood. Not something that happened. He talked about what he understood. These are not difficult understandings. You know, they're not so difficult, the insights. The difficulty is actually absorbing them to a degree that they are unarguable. I mean, there's a remarkable simplicity about this teaching.
So I've heard.
Complexity too, but simplicity.
Stop and just pay attention to what's happening now. And I did that at work. I had a little reminder pop up every day to tell me about the homework, so I remembered to do it. And it was remarkably peaceful, but then I discovered I really didn't want anything to do with that feeling. I had it once, and then the next day I hit the snooze about 50 times on my homework. And then every day after that, and I thought, wow, this is, I had that feeling, and it was actually compelling, but then I didn't want to have it again. I was like, I was running away from that feeling as well. So
because the implications of it might be quite big in your life. Maybe that's why we run away from it. Because the implications about, you know, what it means to live in the light of that might be quite big.
Ha 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 ha.